Chapter 30. They haul themselves from the spikes, impaling them to the ground. Armour splits, dead flesh tears. Ventanus doesn't see any blood pour from the huge holes in their bodies. Any fluid left in them has long since curdled in their veins. They move stiffly, as though they have forgotten how to walk. Or they are just learning. The Neverborn. Ventanus does not know the term, but he immediately understands its substance. These are the fleshless horrors the word-bearers brought forth from the warp. Nightmarish Xenos things from a dimension shut away from the eyes of humanity for good reason. They look out from dead men's skulls, and he feels their insatiable hunger. He doesn't need to issue an order. The horror of the situation demands individual response. Bolt of fire rips through the reanimated word-bearers, each one bleeding black smoke from the exploded meat of their bodies. Wounds sufficient to put down two legionaries barely slow them. They come on with limbs hanging off, bones shattered. The warriors in red crash against the warriors in blue, all adaption complete. These are no sluggish revenants, but warriors as strong and fast in death as they were in life. The numbers are nothing like even, but the demon things squatting in the word-bearer's skulls do not take up their host's weapons to fight. Claws and teeth are their killing tools, not guns. An eternity of war in a timeless dimension is seen to that. It is the only advantage the Ultramarines have. Ventanus shoots with pinpoint accuracy. None of his shots are wasted. Kill shots to the head every time. Inside every skull, a squalling mass of shrieking darkness, solid and gelatinous. A demonic parasite taken up residence in the body of a dead man that vanishes in a screaming implosion of displaced matter. He shoots until the hammer strikes an empty chamber, ejects the magazine, and reloads with a fluid economy of motion. He shoots until his last magazine is expended, and then draws his power sword. The Neverborn throw themselves at him, driven by desperate hunger and loathing. Ventanus sees the hatred in their dead eyes and does not know what he's done to earn it. His sword cuts through armour made heavy without power. Kinetic shock travels up his arm with every blow, but he is energised and ready for this fight. He came here to kill word-bearers, and damn it, that is what he will do. The Neverborn are not silent. They scream as they claw at the Ultramarines, and they shriek as they die. Their cries are tormented, but Ventanus has no pity left in him. Not for himself, and certainly not for the word-bearers. Strobing flashes of gunfire light the dark umbra spreading overhead. Ventanus and Sidance fight back to back. Both have exhausted their stock of ammunition.
"A few more than 12 this time,"
grunts Sidance as he hacks his chainsaw down through a word-bearer's collarbone and sternum with a two-handed grip.
"You mean 13, says Ventanus. "No, only ever 12. Replies Sidance with a grin.
Ventanus understands that grin. They are brothers, and they are equals, and there is a purity to this fight. There are no lofty ideals at stake, no grand strategy in play. It is simple life or death, and there is something to be said for such simplicity. Ventanus cuts heads from shoulders, opens chests, and hacks legs from hips. His blade is always in motion. He employs every move he knows to stay alive. Those learned from the Blade Masters of Macrag, and those picked up in a lifetime of desperate brawls in almost 200 years of war. Telemachus slaughters the word-bearers by the dozen. His assault cannon shreds bodies into their constituent atoms and renders even a corpse warrior unable to fight. They claw at his body, beating broken fists to pulp against his casket. The Contemptor relishes this melee, fighting alongside Icos of the Arm and his shield-bearers. The Tetrarch of Conor is no less lethal with only the one fighting limb. He has fired his pistol empty and kills with the precise strokes of a master fencer. He too has learned the lesson that the only way to put the enemy down for good is to make the decapitating strike. Celoton and his squads are carrying the banner towards the arched portal through which they entered. He is not withdrawing. He is clearing a corridor for the rest of them to use. Ventanus shouts the order to fall back. Something huge and crimson slams into him, knocking him to the ground. He rolls as an armored boot slams down. He swings his sword for the warrior's center mass, but the blade clashes against the bladed octed finial of a rune-inscribed staff.
"Death has come to you," says Fodral Fell, still skewered.
"Death will come when I'm good and ready," answers Ventanus.
Chapter 31. The world spins. Up becomes down, and the ground falls away from Hol Beloth. The starscraper, already on the brink of collapse, needed only a nudge to come crashing down. The blast wave from the cyclonic warhead's detonation at Uranic Radial shatters what uneasy arrangement of vectors still holds it erect. Its foundations break apart, and the structural members at its base buckle like wire in the face of a pounding shockwave. 10 floors collapse in an instant, blown away like dust in a hurricane. The building slumps, its own weight crushing it and dragging it down. Hol Beloth grabs onto an exposed rebar, but it won't be enough to save him. His stomach lurches, and he feels momentarily weightless. He hears Carthos' crazed laughter over the crescendo of shattering steel and exploding permacrete. Floor slabs snap like tinder, and plasteel stanchions, capable of holding up a building kilometers high, unravel like twine. Debris cascades around him, battering him and threatening to tear him from his handhold. The building itself wants to murder him, but he won't let it. Hol Beloth has to stay alive long enough to kill Malok Carthow. The sky falls away. Through a break in the flooring slab that was once over 1,000 meters above ground, he sees the surface of the world opening up. Wide chasms rip jagged traceries through Landshear's outskirts. Hair-fine fault lines tear open, and abyssal canyons gape like gateways to the underworld. Vast clouds of dust and smoke jet into the sky in a cloud to match that above the fiery crater that once housed his army. Hol Beloth can see nothing of the world around him. Everything is noise and fire, dust and impacts. Then he hits the ground. The starscraper doesn't stop. Meters-thick columns smash through the surface of Kalth like pile drivers slammed down by an angry god. The starscraper's colossal mass and momentum plunge it through the rock like a sword thrust. Hundreds of meters down, previously unknown cave voids are broken into. Unconnected galleries and sinkholes, appearing on no map, are suddenly open to the sky. Hol Beloth sees nothing of this. Hundreds of thousands of metric tons cascade down into the revealed cave systems. He is a speck of mortal flesh in a hurricane of eons-old rock. The plates of his armor shatter like glass, bones break, and he feels the shock of furnace heat as his biological repair mechanisms fight to keep him alive. He loses his grip on the rebar and drops through a storm of bludgeoning rock. He falls, spinning downwards from impact to impact. Blood fills his helmet, threatening to drown him. He slams into a rock wall, and it is torn away. He cannot see anything but darkness and a blitzing torrent of debris. Steel and glass fall with him in a shimmering rain. Over the unending fury of deafening noise, Hol Beloth still hears the maddening laughter of the Dark Apostle. At last, his fall ends. His broken body plunges into an icy lake of dark water. It is deep, and the fortunate angle of impact means he only breaks 6 of his ribs and not his spinal column. Freezing water enfolds him, pouring down his throat and into his lungs. He gags and coughs, the deep cold shocking him from the disorientation of his fall. Autonomic responses take over. His throat seals his primary lungs off. Implanted breathing organs alongside his genhanced ones take over. They siphon what little air is left in them and shunt that oxygen directly to his brain. Electrochemical shocks throughout his body jolt him into life, self-induced fibrillation to get his limbs working again. Hol Beloth thrashes, uselessly. He has no buoyancy. His armor is dragging him down. Legionary armor is airtight and therefore watertight, but his has been broken open and shattered. Water rushes to fill it, and the weight is enormous. He struggles to fight its sucking ballast, but his body is too badly hurt, his soul too grievously broken. Hol Beloth sinks deeper, a stream of bubbles spuming from his lips. An arm plunges into the water and a clawed hand grips the broken edge of his pauldron. It is bestial and scaled. Yellow talons score deep grooves in the ceramite as he is dragged back to the surface. Holbeloff is hauled onto a shore of debris and rubble, gasping for breath. He rolls and vomits twin lungfuls of water so cold it burns his throat. He retches until his body is empty of fluid, tasting blood and bile in his mouth. He feels the intramuscular sphincters of his airways switch as he shifts back to his regular breathing pattern. Cold air has never tasted so good. Steam rises from his body, his skin hot to the touch. His incredible physiology is repairing damage that should have killed him outright. That he is alive at all is a miracle, and he looks up to see just how far he has fallen. Dust fogs the air, and a rain of debris tumbles into the cave from the jagged tear in its ceiling. Latticed steelwork from the collapsed starscraper webs the opening torn in the rock like crude stitches, and sparking lengths of high tensile wire and data cabling dangle like jungle creepers. The gloom makes it hard to judge the cave's dimensions, but it is not large, perhaps 100 meters at its widest. The water level of the lake is rising as more debris falls into it. Malloc Carthow squats at the edge of the lake, impossibly unscathed by their fall. Ice water laps at his feet. Holbeloff sees there is something wrong with the Dark Apostle. Darkness clings to the warrior, but it looks like there are too many joints in his legs. Carthow turns his horned head and says, "You live!" as though he is surprised.
"You destroyed my army," says Holbeloff.
Carthow nods.
"Rabble," he says. "Fodder. A meat price."
"Why?"
"You had no need of them," says Carthow. "You have a higher purpose than marching at the head of debased mortals."
"What purpose?"
asks Holbeloff, hating that he cannot hide his urgent desire. The Dark Apostle cocks his head to one side as though the answer is self-evident, but furnishes him with no reply. He looks towards the broken ceiling of the cave, expectant.
"And though the heavens rain fire upon the bearers of the truth, yet shall there be a greater boon given unto them," says Carthow, pulling himself erect.
He is taller now, his body swelling with vitality. The Dark Apostle is on the verge of something incredible. A transformation or an ascension. Darkness seethes within him, a dangerous energy only kept in check by a monumental effort of will. The coming hours will either transform Carthow or destroy him. Holbeloff does not know which he would rather see. Chapter 32. Ventanus raises his sword in a two-handed block as Fodral Fell, or whatever dark force is animating his body, swings a toothed falchion in a diagonal cut. The force behind the blow is enormous. Energized sparks spray from the impact of the blades, and ozone stink fills his nostrils as the servos of his battle armor augment his strength. He rolls his wrists, letting the roaring teeth scrape down his power sword. He sways aside from a blindingly swift return stroke and thrusts for Fell's groin. It is a good strike, powerful and well-aimed. The point lances the crimped joint between Fell's pelvis and thigh. Ventanus twists and wrenches the blade clear. Black blood spills out. The stench is awful, the worst thing in the world. Even the filters of his helm cannot keep it out. He gags, retching dryly. The blood stops flowing, and Fell is not even slowed.
"You kill my kin," says the Neverborn, a froth of disintegrating matter spilling over its lips.
Ventanus does not answer, and attacks again. They trade blows back and forth, and though his skill is the greater, the speed and strength of his opponent is phenomenal. 3 times he avoids death by the narrowest margin. He hears his name called, but can't spare a moment's concentration to see who is shouting to him. The sound of gunfire is a distant echo. The flash of mass reactive detonations barely registers. He is in the middle of furious battle, but all he sees is the demon creature trying to kill him. Fell still has the octet staff piercing him, though it has snapped inside his body. Only the top half remains. 2 warriors in cobalt blue and gold appear beside Ventanus. One has a face of broken porcelain and flesh. The other is in the battle colours of a fourth company captain. He knows them and loves them as brothers. Icos Lamiad fights with economical grace, Lyros Sidance with vengeful fury. His brother captain was always a man given to passionate rages, most of which needed tempering, but Ventanus is grateful for this one. To face a single ultramarine is daunting. Three is certain death. Fodral Fell laughs in their faces. His fortune is a blur, blocking, parrying, and attacking with a speed that should be impossible. Liquid black fire leaps along the length of his blade, and where it touches, it burns legion plate like dry wood.
The savior, the lancer, and the cripple,
giggles Fell, spinning and slamming an elbow into Lamiad's cheek. Facial plates crack further.
The warp knows you.
Bastard!
Cries Sidance, lunging forward. His sword cuts down through Fell's left arm. A spray of the foul blood washes out, along with a host of wriggling things, segmented and waving like worms. Corpse feeders. Sidance gags on the stench, and Fell's falchion sweeps up to take his head. Ventanus blocks the blow and hammers his boot into Fell's gut. The word-bearer staggers under the force of it, the bladed finials of the staff reflecting the light of gunfire. Something fast-moving and powerful strikes it, a rogue shell or a ricochet. The demonic face behind Fell's eyes shudders. Pain racks its body and a gout of boiling black fluid jets from its mouth. It staggers and Ventanus sees his opening. He spins inside Fell's guard and rams his sword through his breastplate. Lightning streams the length of the blade as it punches through ceramite, flesh, bone, and the stuff of night. The tip breaks through the backplate of Fell's armour, but the metal of the blade has aged 1,000 years. Silvered steel is now corroded rust that flakes to ash within moments of exposure to the real world. A pistoning fist slams Ventanus back as he hears his name being shouted again. He hits the ground hard and tries to rise. Something is holding him down. Icos Lamiad, his face a horror of ruined flesh where his mask has been shattered, has him pinned to the ground.
Tetra! Shouts Ventanus. What?
Lamiad shakes his head as a towering shadow falls over them. A giant in tar-slicked ceramite, a titan who fell from the skies and lived to tell of it. One arm is a crushing fist, the other a colossal cannon of spinning barrels. A hurricane of fire roars from its muzzles. Hundreds of shells expend in moments. Fodral Fell's body explodes. The assault cannon's fire is relentless, unforgiving. Its aim never wavers, and the wretched matter of the Neverborn is atomized.
You will not harm him,
says Telemachus the Contemptor. Chapter 33. Malloc Carthow squats by the water's edge, waiting. Time passes, but without his helmet, Hall Belloth has no way to accurately measure it. Hours, two, maybe three. He drifts in and out of consciousness as his body diverts energy from his thought processes to healing. There is no change in the light. They have survived a fall that ought to have killed them instantly, which tells Hall Belloth that the Dark Apostle still has an endgame in mind. Yet they have wasted time in this cave, doing nothing. If there is mayhem to be made, then Hall Belloth wishes to be about it. Determined to take action, he looks for a way out. 50 meters to his left, a wide fissure in the walls leads deeper into the rock. Something metallic gleams on the ground next to the opening. Hall Belloth forces himself upright. Pain from numerous fractures shoots up his legs. He forces it down as he limps around the edge of the lake to the fissure. Stagnant air wafts from the opening. He takes a long breath, his neuroglottis picking out chemical traces of welded steel and setting permacrete. He squats at the opening and lifts the gleaming object from the ground, turning it around in his hands like a precious relic. It is a cartography drone, a bulbous cylinder equipped with a repulsor field and numerous Auspex arrays. Its power cells are virtually exhausted, and its caliper limbs twitch like the feelers of a dying insect. A blinking red gem light on its frontal lobe tells Hall Belloth that it is trying and failing to link back to its control station. A tech marine could easily repair it, but he has no skill with machines. It takes a moment for Hall Beloth to realize the significance of this find. He turns as booming splashes, like boulders falling into the lake, fill the cave with spray. Malloc Carthow rises on his oddly jointed legs. He wipes cold water from his face as more huge objects splash down into the water from above. The surface of the lake churns and slaps the rock. A trail of bubbles moves towards the shore. Hall Beloth watches as Eriash Kigal and his Terminators rise from the dark waters like drowned sailors return to unnatural life. Water pours from the battered plates of their armour, and as each one reaches the Dark Apostle, he is anointed with three crosswise slashes across his breastplate. Without knowing how, Hall Beloth senses a significance to the thrice-clawed mark. Then a bloated shape of hard red metal emerges from the water, a leviathan of the deeps, the dreadnought Zu'Gannara. Its casket drips black water and what looks like molten scads of metal that are running in rivulets from its armoured flanks. It is as though the dreadnought is melting, as though the void dark within is consuming the matter containing its substance. It still carries the weapon stolen from CV-427 Praxor, its biohazard symbol like a beacon of hope in the gloom of the cave.
"And the devourer of life shall be born into the belly of the beast," says Carthow, turning to Hall Beloth.
The Dark Apostle gestures to the fissure in the rock where Hall Beloth found the damaged drone. A forked tongue of corrugated flesh licks jagged teeth. Hall Beloth knows the Dark Apostle tastes what he has tasted. Turned earth, blasted rock, construction. A way in.
"The Unveiled One shall open the way," says Carthow, "and he that was lost shall lead the faithful to the slaughter."
Hall Beloth holds up the cartography drone. Purpose fills him, and he throws the machine out into the water. It drops into the darkness, the red gemlight fading as it sinks to the bottom of the lake. He looks back at the fissure that leads to the heart of the enemy's lair.
"The belly of the beast," says Hall Beloth, the pain of his many wounds forgotten.
"We are the blade that opens it,"
promises Malloc Carthow. Chapter 34. Subiaco cannot escape the grip of his nightmare. He is awake. He knows this, but wishes he were not. His nightmare has followed him into the waking world. His wife's face, the skin ruddy and gracefully aged, is crumbling parchment, flaking and diseased. Even his children, youngsters barely of age to stand in the youth auxilia, bear the scars of time's assault. He flees his hab, barely dressed, and sees that everything he has feared has come to pass. Beyond the walls of the Ultimus, the billions of tons of rock that keeps them safe is no more than a paper-thin veneer of flaking ash and wire, a structure so fragile he cannot bear to look at it, or the unimaginable ocean-dark presences uncoiling behind it. The planet shifts and creaks as void-born gales strip the world's substance away with every breath. Subiaco screams, but his words are snatched away by cold winds whose origin has no place and no time. Thousands upon thousands of faces surround him, but he sees them for what they truly are, rotting puppets that degenerate with every passing second, a multitude that does not know how close their death really is. Tap, tap, tap. Subiaco hears the polished steel talons of the beasts once again. They have broken the walls of sleep and are coming for him. The ragged cloth-tear sound of dread claws being ripped through dimensions grates down his spine, and he breaks into a run. Wounded faces turn and question him. Their words are gurgling death rattles. He pushes past them, knocking many to the ground. Wet claws and lamprey-like mouths press up from the ground, sensing the nearness of prey. Nobody sees them, and Subiaco's warnings fall upon deaf ears. Subiaco runs, down into the deeps, away from the masses of the dead in waiting. He runs past the places he has worked since finding sanctuary in Arcology X. He runs until the acid burns in his limbs and his lungs fill with bile. The hunting beasts are close. He feels their nearness. He dares not look back. The very sight of them will paralyze him. And there is only one escape. He hears voices behind him and ignores them. At last, he reaches his salvation, the Cyclopean gate with a clockwork angel puzzle sealing it shut. He's almost hysterical with relief. There are giants here, warriors whose bodies are just as rotten as those above, but which are locked in an eternal battle with the forces that drive their flesh to its doom. Subiaco ignores them. They are just as dead as the thousands of people above. Tap, tap, tap. He has no time, none. Subiaco climbs to the clockwork angel, and it seems that its wings reach out to enfold him. He hears his name barked in the booming tones of a being whose physiology has been so altered and enhanced that it barely qualifies as human. The authority and warning are unmistakable, but he is too far gone to stop now. He punches the solution to the age-old riddle of the clockwork angel into the ornate keyboard of brass and jet. The mechanisms of the door break apart as command codes of the Ingenium are accepted by the locking seal. Resonant harmonic frequencies blast through the permacrete, turning it to powder in the blink of an eye. A falling curtain of dissolving permacrete is the last thing he sees as his chest cavity detonates explosively in a fan of shattered bone. Sergeant Ancreon's mass reactive kills Ingenium Subiaco instantly. His body falls from the platform before the locking seal as wetted chain fists, lightning claws and thunder hammers tear through from the other side. Chapter 35. Eriish Kigal kills the first ultramarine with a spray of bolts from his combi weapon. He kills the next one too. His warriors fan out around him. Those with guns fill the space with explosive bolts. Ricochets and splintered rock fly through the air. Answering gunfire spanks from the massive plates of their Terminator armor. Las rounds are ineffective, and mass reactives only marginally less so. Hol Belloff has only his sword and wades into the fight like one of Angron's gladiators. Aside from a few ultramarines, who are even now falling back, there is little sport to be had here. His blade is wet and red, but it is the thin blood of mortals. It drips from his blade as Malok Kartho squeezes his growing bulk through the hole torn in the shuttering that sealed this tunnel off from the underground lake. Zhu Ganara comes next, still carrying the world killer in his mechanized arms. Word of their coming will already be racing to the heart of this arcology. Fear will strike at the hearts of its people. They will know that death has come to them. Hol Belloff's body is a searing furnace. His skin smokes with it, and the rotten smell of sulfur fills his nose and mouth. It seems the Dark Apostle is not the only one on the verge of a transformation. Hol Belloff has longed for this moment since first he set foot on Kalth, and he can literally taste his reward. Eriish Kigal and his Terminators lead the way, climbing higher with every passing moment. The cave is wide and filled with gunfire. A squad of ultramarines and some uniformed mortals in the colours of the Defence Auxilia are shooting at them. They cower in hastily erected barricades. He sees that each man has a black X daubed somewhere on his armour. He does not understand the significance of this, and dismisses it as irrelevant. Hol Belloff feels a stinging sensation at his chest, and sees a black burn scar from a las impact. The skin is curdled and scorched, but he feels no pain. None at all. The tunnel turns and widens, its ceiling rising up to almost 30 metres. More soldiers are moving to intercept them. Gunfire intensifies. None of it matters. Three ultramarines attempt to impose order on the few soldiers at their disposal. A pair of armoured vehicles rumble into view, a rhino and a civilian cargo transporter with a pair of heavy stubbers welded onto a primitive turret. The rhino's guns hammer the Terminators, and one of the mighty warriors stumbles as the heavier weight of fire finds a weak spot. Hol Belloff wonders why it is taking so long for the ultramarines to respond to the terrible threat in their midst. Then he understands the sacrifice of Fodral Fell. The ultramarines are not here, not in any numbers of significance. The gunner of the Rhino brackets the wounded Terminator and hammers him again and again. It is a successful tactic, as the percussive chain of explosions eventually cracks the armor open. The warrior within is cut apart, and his armor sags with his death. Malok Kartho leaps into the air, his reverse-jointed legs powering him over the heads of the Ultramarines. He is in amongst them, his clawed arms like threshing blades. He rips them apart, tearing warplate open with his bare hands and hurling body parts aside like butcher's waste. Bolt rounds flatten upon his iron-hard flesh. Blades bounce off him. His laughter is that of a being who has achieved his heart's desire and found it more wondrous than he ever hoped. The Ultramarines are dead, and Kartho charges the Rhino. Its driver sees the danger and guns the engine. The tracks spin furiously, but not fast enough. Kartho smashes into the vehicle like a wrecking ball. The hull of the Rhino buckles inwards explosively. Flames rip from within, and the engine gives out with a hard bang of combustion. Kartho's charge has broken the tank in two. A sweep of his bulging arms hurls the wreckage away. Eriesh Kigal kills the up-armed civilian transporter. A hail of high-impact rounds blows its engine block apart, and the explosion lifts it 10 meters into the air. His Terminators are unstoppable juggernauts. Small arms fire is an irrelevance, and they are proof against most blades. Storms of fire batter the curved plates and layered plastrons, but none of it has any effect. An unstoppable line of armor pushes inexorably forward, climbing higher into the arcology with every passing moment. The armed forces that remain here will be mustering above, but they will be too late to prevent the wholesale destruction of Kalth. There are too few defenses here to stop the word-bearers. In their arrogance, the Ultramarines think they are secure, that their way of doing things is the only way. Blind to the virtues of free thinking, the 13th have sealed their fate by clinging to an outmoded way of war. The old ways are gone, and a new order is rising. The Ultramarines have failed to embrace that. It will be their undoing. Hol Beloth grunts in sudden pain. The enemy has not wounded him. This is not the already forgotten pain of a gunshot or a sword cut. Things are breaking inside his body. Bones shift, elongate. Organs squirm and reshape themselves. Blood grows sluggish as its composition alters. His vision blurs as nictitating membranes form over his eyes. Old pain diminishes, and new pain replaces it. Hol Beloth throws away his sword. The blade is broken just above the hilt, but he has no memory of it snapping. He has a dagger at his hip, one of the crude flint-bladed things Erebus presented to the Anointed Ones. He does not draw it. He has no need of it now, for his fingers sprout claws like sword blades. Flames and the cries of the dying are all that they leave in their wake. More slaughter awaits ahead. Hol Beloth ascends into the administration level of Arcology X. He sees thousands of mortals cowering here, clustered around a building of polished white marble. He no longer sees as he once did. His sight is that of a voracious predator. His world is blood hues, flesh smells, and fear stink. It is good. Chapter 36. The Defense Auxilia and Ingenium Support Division are responding with incredible speed. Army units integrated into the chain of command are already in place, but Hamadri fears it is too little too late. She watches the word-bearers fight their way into the sprawling administration level from the upper hatch of a chimera. How can they be here? She asks herself, knowing that the question is meaningless now. Captain Ulliot is already fighting, his salamander command vehicle racing back and forth at the entrance to the sub-caves. No sooner had Sergeant Ancrion's warning of the breach in the lower levels gone out over every active Vox network than the tanks of the 77th Support Division roared into action. His vehicles are cargo carriers, engineering rigs, and combat support tanks. Armed with anti-personnel weapons, they are no match for Space Marine Terminators. The Defense Auxilia moves to assist, Hamadri's orders sending her tanks around the flanks to keep the enemy boxed in. Her chimera bounces over the uneven ground, and Hamadri sees how few enemy warriors there are. 6 Terminators and a Dreadnought, and two monstrous things to which he can give no name. One is taller than the dreadnought, its flesh blackening even as she looks at it, as though it burns in a fire she cannot see. The other is a hunched, swollen thing with scraps of blood-red plate embedded in the mass of its body. Its engorged muscles expand like overfilled fuel bladders, and its arms end in flailing bone swords. It would, on paper, be a paltry force with which to invade Arcology X. But it may well be enough. "Bring us in on the right," she orders her driver. The Chimera slews around, its tracks spitting rock fragments. Hamadri brings the rotor cannon around and depresses the firing triggers. Thudding recoil slams back against her palms, but she keeps the weapon on target. A stream of bullets strikes the monster with the bone swords, and her shots only falter when the thing looks up at her with eyes that are windows into madness. The beast vaults into the air, an impossible leap. Hamadri cranks the pintle-mounted weapon around and opens fire. The angle is too steep, her shots too low. The creature lands on the Chimera's frontal section with a ringing hammer blow. The impact is colossal, its weight out of all proportion to its size. The Chimera's hull is crushed, and the tank turns end over end like a flipped Aquila coin. Hamadri has a fraction of a second's life left. She wonders if her son, in the numinous 61st, is still alive. Better that he is dead than have to fight a war against such monsters. The Chimera slams down on its topside, and Colonel Ryok Hamadri joins the long list of those killed in action. Chapter 37. The change is upon him. His flesh is becoming. The rituals have been observed, the sacrifices made. Malok Hartho has attracted the eye of the gods, and he feels the immense power that awaits him. He awaits the judgment of his worth. The muttering shadows are gone, drawn to the trap in Fodral Fell's stronghold. But he has no need of them now. He will be his own shadow now, shedding his old identity and clearing out what could have been. The last piece of him awaits his final offering. He still senses the warp power's unwillingness to give up its hunt. It has its prey practically in its jaws, but his need is the greater. Without that power, his frame will explosively mutate. It will be cast down in a wallowing pit of mindless depravity, a worthy fate for some, but not for him. He watches Hall-Beloth kill with ferocious abandon. The commander's mind has fractured, and this last betrayal is the pact with which he seals his bargain with the monarchs of the warp. Eriesh Kigal's terminators are still in the fight, though another one has been brought down. The enemy is rallying and bringing their heavier guns to bear. They still think the word-bearers are here to conquer, to capture. He laughs, and those mortals who hear him fall dead instantly. Kartho turns to Zu-Gunara. That name is meaningless. Zu-Gunara died for the second time weeks ago. The dreadnought that once housed his flesh still carries the bioweapon, and now it holds it out to him like an offering. He supposes that is exactly what it is. The Life-Eater virus is a gift from the gods. The fighting continues behind him, but he no longer cares. Kartho opens the arming panel and enters the codes he memorized long ago when the scrap code attack first compromised Kalth's defense network. The virus bomb circuitry comes to life, and a green light bathes the interior of its arming mechanics. The cogskull insignia of the Mechanicum and the Ultima of the 13th Legion flash baleful warnings. No provision exists for instant deployment, only a preset countdown. It will make no difference. More warnings chime from the interior of the bomb as he unlocks each security protocol. He ignores them and turns the final arming trigger before snapping it off. Numerous failsafes and redundancies exist to reset the countdown. Kartho destroys them all. The bomb broadcasts a final countdown signal across a multitude of vox bands and sets off an unmistakable alarum bray. Such warnings are pointless. Anything close enough to register them will be killed by the release of the virus within minutes. He sees the realization of what he has done spread through the Imperial soldiers. Those who don't recognize the threat of the virus bomb's shrieking warning learn through the vox what he has brought into their midst. Soldiers turn and flee. Armoured vehicles blow their engines as they throw their tracks into reverse. The panic and terror is almost overwhelming, and Cartho roars with laughter as he sees the vaunted Ultramarian discipline collapse in the face of certain death. A few braver souls run towards the bomb, perhaps thinking they can disarm it. They're deluding themselves. He feels his bargain with a warp sealed in the depths of his transforming flesh. His body has been prepared, and now the communion of material and spiritual can take place. Cartho lifts his hand and sees a glimmer of silver wreathe the tips of his claws. His very flesh is a knife with which he can cut through the dimensional walls. He senses this is borrowed power, a fleeting gift to enable his union with the warp. Cartho slashes his hand down through the air, and the material wall of the universe parts before him. A poisoned wind gusts from the deep wound, a gateway to the domain of gods and monsters. Soon, he will be both. He feels another of Kigal's terminators die. His senses are beyond anything he has known before, and this is just the beginning of his ascension. He pulls the wavering tear in the universe wider, tasting the dark promise of the miasmic void beyond. This will be his realm now, not the tasteless material plane of mortals. But just before he steps through, Malok Cartho experiences something he thought long since bled out onto the sands of Colchis. He knows doubt. He turns from the howling gate in time to see a pair of rad-scarred land speeders streak into the cavern. Their engines are overheating and flying on fumes. They have been pushed far beyond their limits to get here. A pointless gesture. This bomb will detonate. Nothing now can prevent that. Riding tall in the lead skimmer is an unhelmed warrior in blue and gold. Malok Cartho has never seen him before, but his transformed senses recognize him immediately. Remus Ventanus. Chapter 38. The administrative level is in chaos. Civilians and soldiers alike flee in terror from the figures standing at the heart of the cave. A dreadnought and a thick-limbed figure of black scales whose body seems to flicker with dark flame. This is the leader of this dark host. Ventanus knows it in his bones. The dreadnought carries the screaming bomb in its hands, and every frequency is telling him that the Life-Eater warhead is on the verge of detonation. A Word-Bearer's Terminator is still fighting, but Sidance's speeder is diving towards him. The Terminator has armor that can survive impact with a super-heavy. Sidance has a multi-melter. He sees a flash and hears the roar of superheated air, but he doesn't see what happens to the Terminator. The speeder lurches, its engine spluttering its death rattle. That it has brought him this far is nothing short of a miracle. Celoton has pushed the engine as hard as he can, and now it is done.
"Take us down!"
Ventanus yells over the screams and chatter of gunfire. Celoton nods.
"Don't think we've much choice, Captain."
Before the speeder can descend, Ventanus hears a bestial roar. An abominable creature with sword-blade arms vaults from the back of a crushed rhino. It is coming straight at them.
"Incoming!"
he yells. The speeder heels over as Celoton wrenches it around, but even legionary reflexes aren't quite fast enough. The creature's bladed arms slice the vehicle in half, taking Celoton's legs at mid-thigh. Ventanus leaps clear as the speeder ploughs rock and wrecks itself in an explosion of flying steel. He lands at the run and has his bolter out a second later. He does not know if Celoton has survived the crash and has no time to check. The beast that brought them down rears up, a wall of expanding tissue and claws. He sees it was once a man, a legionary like him. But whatever hypermutations are racking its frame are completely out of control. Limbs burst from grisly tumours and fanged mouths erupt across its malleable flesh. Ventanus empties a magazine into the creature. His shells punch through its metamorphosing body. He hears the detonations, but the creature does not even appear to feel them. He reaches for another magazine, but a heavy paw the size of his chest slams him to the ground. Its bulk is enormous, swelling and evolving in an uncontrolled frenzy. He reaches for his sword, a chain weapon taken to replace his lost power blade. The creature is screaming. He cannot tell if it is in anger or pain. Ventanus thrusts the sword into the rippling folds of new flesh, and the suction is so great that it tears the blade from his grip. The monster's body swallows the chainsword whole, and Ventanus reaches for his next weapon. He unclips a pair of frag grenades from his belt, one in each hand. Part of him knows that this is folly. The Life-Eater virus will destroy the monster regardless of this fight's outcome, but it matters to Ventanus that it dies by his hand. He punches the grenades into the thing's body, releasing them before his arms suffer the same fate as his sword. Both grenades detonate with a wet thump, showering him with rancid flesh as raw as protoplasm. Open wounds gape, bloody and stringy with unformed matter. The creature doesn't die. It is too large now, but he has hurt it. It shrieks from its hundreds of mouths. He has a moment at best to capitalize on its pain. Then he sees it. In one gaping wound is a grey-bladed dagger, a weapon clinging to a leather belt that has been subsumed by the expanding flesh of the monster. He knows what it is. He has used such a weapon before. Hating that he has no choice, Ventanus reaches in and drags the dagger from the sopping fleshy wound. He feels the legacy of murder imbued in the glitter-sheened blade. This weapon has a bloody history, but it also has power, and he needs that now. It is a pitifully small thing to wield against so bloated a foe, but Ventanus has first-hand experience of what harm such weapons are capable of wreaking. The monster's face looms over him, a bloated mass of gibbering mouths, lunatic eyes, and lashing tongues. Whoever this once was, he is long gone. Ventanus wonders if he understands what he has become. A wide mouth of erupting fangs and acidic bile snaps towards him. "For Kalth!" shouts Ventanus and rams the blade up into its throat. The effect is instantaneous and horrific. The monster tears open, folding in on itself in unravelling slabs of blood-soaked flesh and fat. Hybrid organs necrotize in seconds, and its expanding matter blackens in the space of a breath. The reek of a mass grave gusts from its instantaneous decomposition, and gouts of stinking black fluid jet from nameless masses of diseased flesh. Ventanus staggers back, repulsed beyond measure at the creature's death. Somewhere in the midst of its unmaking, he sees hints of a post-human body, but they too disintegrate before his eyes. He spits a gobbet of rank fluid and switches his gaze to the immobile dreadnought that holds the virus bomb. The scaled black figure with a curling horn stares venom at him. It turns and vanishes through a shimmering hole in the world. Ventanus feels nauseous at the sight of such a violation, at the sickness he sees through the cut. The tear is already growing smaller. The fabric of the world is healing itself, and in seconds the opening will be gone. The dagger in his hand tugs at his grip. It wants to return to that unclean realm, to go back to where it was made.
"Silence!"
shouts Ventanus, calling up the bomb's countdown to his visor.
"To me!"
A blue speeder slews around behind him.
"How long?"
asks Silence.
10 seconds! Now get out!"
"What?"
"No! I'm going with you!"
"Not this time," says Ventanus. "This time there is no 13th Eldar."
He kicks Sidance from the speeder and drops into the pilot's seat. The engine belches a plume of irradiated smoke, and the skimmer lurches forward, Ventanus coaxing it to one last ride. The speeder vibrates as though it's about to shake itself apart. The harsh bangs of engine misfire sound behind him, and a plume of flame billows in his wake.
"Come on, fly, damn you!"
shouts Ventanus. The speeder is descending on failing grav plates, its power almost exhausted, its engine dead. He fights to keep it in the air, hauling the control column back and feeding his every last scrap of will and belief into the machine. The dreadnought looms before him like some immovable leviathan. Ventanus drops the warp-tainted dagger onto the gunner's seat.
"For courage and honour!"
he shouts.
"For the Emperor!"
A last surge of power fills the engine, and Ventanus triggers the forward guns as he throws himself from the speeder. He hits the ground hard and rolls as the skimmer smashes into the dreadnought at full speed. The collision is ferocious. The speed is momentum, unstoppable. The dreadnought rocks back on its piston legs. Then the engine block explodes, and the blast throws it back. Its gyroscopic stabilizers fight for balance. They fail. The dreadnought falls and is swallowed by the sucking wound in the world. It vanishes from Kalth, and the tear seals up behind it. Ventanus holds his breath, counting the seconds. He waits for an explosion that never comes. He doesn't know where the bomb with its lethal life-eater virus has gone, but it is not on Kalth. That is good enough for him. He turns to the sound of cheering. It takes him a moment to realize that it is for him. The people of Arcology X are shouting his name. No, not his name. His title. Savior of Kalth. And for the first time, Remus Ventanus feels that he has earned it.
No one is coming, then. Our numbers don't count. That's it, isn't it? We Southern Islanders are just too scattered. Our cities aren't big enough. The enemy turned our lands to glass and ash. How could there be survivors? No point in looking, right? To whoever finds this, I don't want this to be easy for you. I survived. Do you understand? I survived the wave and the fires. The enemy is gone and I'm still out here. Only now the sun is killing me, and I don't know why, and the sky is still empty of help. Damn you. Damn all of you.